Till Death Do Us Part is a lighthearted and sometimes satirical true crime podcast where we present our dysfunctional married take on serious cases involving other dysfunctional relationships. We hope you enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to my parents' annoying podcast called Till Death Do Us Part. Is that fine?
That's great.
Okay.
Yes, and welcome to episode 119.
I am the parent that is responsible for that human.
And I'm the other parent named Melissa.
We are the co-parents. All right, so you put out to our listeners any suggestions for anything better than what I could come up with for a factoid. And they delivered.
So we're just going to jump into factoids?
Oh, I don't know. What are we doing?
There's nothing else you want to say?
No.
Okay.
Straight to the point.
Straight to factoids. Okay, let's do it.
Did you have something you wanted to share?
No. I just figured it would flow.
What would flow?
I don't know. We are so professional. Yes. On Instagram, I asked people to tell us what sort of factoids they would want to hear from you. And did they deliver?
Yes. And I want to.
Oh my gosh.
I want to thank.
Thank you all so much.
I want to thank you because I can't think of anything anymore.
I know.
My mind's just gone. It is shot.
You've done a lot of factoids over the last couple years.
So, Palmetto Gal.
71.
71, to be specific, suggested, what the hell are these serial killers eating before they are, or death row? Death row?
Well, she said killers. Favorite meals of serial killers, which I assume is favorite.
Okay.
Death row or favorite last meal.
Okay. So we continued that with what did they want to eat before they were put to death?
Yes.
All right. So here we go. And this is an Associated Press. It says 9 News. So I guess if you want to look that up and not find it, that would be fine. This is what serial killers ate as their last meal on death row, to be specific. Okay?
Okay.
All right. Good. I'm just going to do them in order.
Go for it.
Oklahoma executed 59-year-old death row inmate Philip Hancock, who was sentenced to death for the 2001 double murder of Robert Jett and James Lynch. Hancock had claimed the killings were done in self-defense. Before his death, Hancock had one simple request for his final meal. He requested fried chicken with no sides.
Fried chicken.
Fried chicken, no sides.
Homemade fried chicken.
I guess so.
Not Kentucky Fried Chicken, not Popeyes.
What if they just went out to like a gas station and just got some day-old fried chicken from the under-the-heater thing, you know? I would.
Why not?
What's he going to do?
Probably cheaper.
Yeah, save some money. Anthony Sanchez was executed by lethal injection for the 1996 murder of 21-year-old Julie Buskin, who was bound, raped, and shot in the head near Lake Stanley Draper in far southeastern Oklahoma City on December 20th of that year.
Oh, God.
Of 1996. The murder went unsolved for years until new DNA evidence matched Sanchez, who was serving time for burglary.
Thank God for DNA.
Right? For his last meal, Sanchez asked for chicken fried steak, fried okra, mashed potatoes and gravy, a roll, sweet iced tea, and apple pie with vanilla ice cream. That's too much. That's just too much.
That's probably something I would want to eat.
Sounds good.
No. Fried okra? Yes, please.
Sanchez, who always maintained that he was innocent, was put to death by lethal injection. Popular one? Not really. I don't know if you say popular. Well known. How's that?
Okay.
John Wayne Gacy.
No, you can say popular. People buy his paintings.
Okay.
That's how insane
we have gotten. What the hell is wrong with people?
I don't know. What the hell is wrong with us?
Well, I'm not buying his painting. No. Well, anyway, John Wayne Gacy, responsible for at least 33 murders and countless rapes of boys. John Wayne Gacy is remembered as one of America's worst serial killers. Before getting the lethal injection in 1994, Gacy asked for a bucket of KFC chicken.
Oh, there you go.
12 fried prawns, a pound of strawberries, French fries, and a Diet Coke because, you know, you got to watch your
figure,
calorie intake. Hell. Gacy had managed 3 KFC restaurants in his younger life. In addition to volunteering as a clown to entertain children in hospital.
They should have gone to Popeyes and not KFC. That would have been hilarious. Bastard.
David Earl Miller, Tennessee's longest waiting death row inmate. David Earl Miller was a 22-year-old drifter living with a church pastor when he brutally murdered 23-year-old Lee Standifer in 1981. The young woman met Miller for a drink before they went back to the pastor's house, and Miller smashed her skull with a fire poker and repeatedly stabbed her. The now 61-year-old requested fried chicken.
See?
As his final meal.
Do you think it's because the skin of the chicken?
I can't now. I was going to have fried chicken tomorrow. No, I wasn't. He had successfully appealed against death by lethal injection and instead faced the electric chair. So that's, you know, careful what you ask for, I guess, right?
Wow.
His last words were, quote, "It beats being on death row."
Does it? Does it now?
All right. On to Timothy McVeigh.
Oh, God. I know what he had.
This fine fella killed 168 people and injured hundreds more when he detonated a truck bomb underneath a federal government building in Oklahoma City in 1995. McVeigh expressed...
I remember when that happened.
McVeigh expressed no regrets over the devastating act of domestic terrorism. He requested...
I know. Do you want me to say?
What did he request?
Mint chip ice cream.
2 pints of mint chocolate chip ice cream as his last meal before his lethal injection.
I had heard he was lactose intolerant.
Well,
I didn't. I'm teasing.
That would be amazing.
No, I know.
It takes a while, though.
That's what I mean. He's like, well, I got an hour, so.
I got a coworker that's lactose intolerant. He goes, man, I really want some ice cream. And I'm like, I thought you're lactose intolerant. He goes, oh, yeah, but I won't have diarrhea for a while. All right, let's move on.
Oh, no. I got the weird laugh going on.
Fritz Herrmann.
See?
Friedrich Heinrich Karl Herrmann.
Oh, gosh. It's a serial killer. He can mess up his name.
Became known as the Butcher of Hanover after he sexually assaulted, murdered, and mutilated at least 24 boys.
No.
And young men in Germany in the wake of World War I.
I can't listen to those anymore.
In accordance with German tradition, Herrmann, and it's like 17 A's in it, was not told of his scheduled execution until the night before. In lieu of a last meal, he was granted an expensive cigar and a cup of Brazilian coffee, and he was beheaded by guillotine. See, now you're happy that I went all the way
to the... Now I have a big smile on my face.
To the end, okay.
Yep. They need to bring back the beheadings.
Oh my gosh. I mean, for special occasions.
Yeah.
Like that one. Peter Curtin. Peter, what's the U with the two dots over the top of it? I'm trying to remember.
Cure?
How it's.
Cure? Oh, you mean like Norwegian?
Yeah, but I
don't remember.
I really do know. I just kind of forgot. But I.
Uh-huh. Bjergen?
I used to know. Anyway. So I apologize, but I'm going to.
You can mess up serial killers' names. That should be allowed. We should be able to make fun of them no matter what.
Okay, well, this is kind of interesting but horrible.
Okay.
Peter Kurschen was nicknamed the Vampire of Dusseldorf for a series of gruesome murders committed in the German city in 1929. Before his scheduled execution by guillotine 2 years later, Kurschen was granted a last meal of Wiener Schnitzel. Fried potatoes, and a bottle of white wine.
Ooh, Wiener Schnitzel.
He asked for seconds, and his request was granted.
No.
And then he was unhinged.
When you were sentenced to death, it was like a year later you were gone, right. Or even sooner.
Well, it's efficient.
Yeah.
Okay, so for all of those of you that are starting to get really mad at men, Eileen Wuornos.
Yes.
Killed seven men while working as a prostitute in Florida in 1989 and 1990.
You're not supposed to say prostitute anymore.
I am reading this verbatim from the Associated Press.
Okay.
She ultimately declined a last meal and instead asked for a cup of black. How do you know all these?
I don't know.
God.
I just know.
She got a cup of black coffee. Yeah. Her last words reflected an unbalanced mental state. Would you like to hear what she said? Of course you would. Yes, I would just like to say I'm sailing with the rock and I'll be back like Independence Day with Jesus, June 6, like the movie, she said. Big mothership and all. I'll be back. I'll be back.
Ooh, Independence Day with Will Smith. That's what she's talking about.
Except it was all wrong and mixed up and she's, yeah.
She's well, that's what she's basing it on. That was a great movie.
Okay, this
guy. The second one sucked.
This guy has the crazy eyes. Richard Cooey.
I don't know that. Ooh, no.
See? All right. No. There you go. No, but wait. This is interesting.
That's going to haunt my dreams.
Richard Cooey, also known as Dick. No, I just made that up. I'm sorry. Richard Cooey. In 1986, 19-year-old Richard Cooey raped, stabbed, and tortured two college students in Akron, Ohio.
Okay.
It took nearly 20 years for Cooey to be put to death while the killer famously arguing that at 125 kilograms, he was too obese to be executed. Hmm. He's a rather large fella.
So he just ate himself into obesity so then he could appeal on the basis of his obesity.
Sure.
That's ridiculous.
His last meal reflected his appetite. Are you ready? Get a piece of paper and a pencil. It's long.
Okay.
He asked for a T-bone steak, onion rings, French fries, four fried eggs, and buttered toast, hash browns, a bucket of Rocky Road ice cream, bear claw pastries, and a bottle of, you guessed it, Mountain Dew.
You should only be given like $10 for your last meal.
Yeah.
That was like at least $100, $200 now.
It took him until midnight to finish eating his last meal, and he was executed the next morning.
They should have given him cucumbers and tomatoes.
Oh, I would have.
And some cottage cheese, low-fat cottage cheese.
Moldy cabbage.
Oh, God. Just
that's it.
Been like,
and
here you go.
And some hot water. Ted Bundy, one of the most notorious serial killers in America. Ted Bundy confessed to murdering 30 young women and girls, but the true number is suspected to be much higher.
Mm-hmm.
Bundy did not make a food request on death row, so was given the default last meal in the Florida State Prison, steak, eggs, toast with butter and jam, hash browns, coffee, and juice. He didn't have a single bite.
Okay. I mean, it sounds like a fabulous meal.
All right, last one. Scotty Morrow. Scotty Morrow was executed by lethal injection in Georgia on May 2nd, 2019 for the murders of his ex-partner Barbara Ann Young and her friend Tanya Rochelle Woods on December 29th, 1994. He requested a huge last meal of a hamburger with mayonnaise, two chicken and waffle meals, a pint of butter pecan ice cream, a bag of buttered popcorn, two all-beef franks, and a large lemonade. That's it.
Wouldn't it have been poetic if he would have choked on one of those all beef franks?
Yeah.
That would have been pretty sweet.
Yeah. Died with a wiener in his mouth. Sorry.
Oh my gosh.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know.
Oh, the things you say, sir.
Died with a wiener schnitzel in his mouth.
Oh boy. All right. Well, that was great. Thanks, Palmetto, for your recommendation. Even if that wasn't your recommendation, that's what we took from it.
I think that's what you asked for. Enjoy your fried chicken.
And I took screenshots of all the other ones. I mean, you guys seriously brought it with all your suggestions.
Thank you.
Maybe we'll do that for the next 30 episodes. We'll just pick one from one of the suggestions.
That would make my job so much easier.
Wouldn't it, though?
Because they're like, oh, Daniel. You couldn't think of anything better than that. There you go. You're welcome. Terrible.
Daniel.
Mm-hmm.
You ready for my case?
Yep.
All right. This is the case of Leonard Ewing and Evelyn Scott.
Okay.
Leonard Ewing actually went by L. Ewing and then went by Ewing. So I'm going to refer to him as Ewing.
Okay.
Most of my information on this case came from the book titled Corpus Delicti, or as some people refer to it, as Corpus Delicti, by Diane Wagner, and then, of course, all the court records from the case. I looked up how to say corpus delicti or corpus delicti because I was hearing it multiple ways. Now, I found a video on YouTube,
okay,
and I'm going to play it.
Okay.
So you guys can hear this. Now, what do you think it is, Daniel? How would you say it? It's Latin.
Yeah, I would say it's corpus delicti.
Okay. I'm going to give you the definition of this.
Great.
It means, in Latin, body of crime.
Oh, okay.
In Western law is the principle that a crime must be proved to have occurred before a person can be convicted of committing that crime. So what they're really looking for is blood evidence or a corpse.
Okay.
Body of evidence.
Yeah.
All right. Now I'm going to play you this.
Have it your way, but we have the bat's corpus delicti and the exclusive picture.
Where is it, Father? Where's the corpus delicti?
Shucks. The records. But, Your Honor, there is a corpus delicti. Remember? It was your wife's love.
And you couldn't be convicted. He studied law and the term corpus delicti, which basically means there must be evidence before.
Yep. I'm still going with corpus delicti, not delicti.
So some people are saying delicti or delicti.
Delicti. You said ancient Latin.
It's
well,
Latin.
You said Latin, so it's ancient. It's kind of redundant.
I just felt like there were a lot of people with very strong opinions on how to say that. So I needed to show, or I needed to prove, that people say it two different ways.
Beyond reasonable doubt.
Yes.
Sure.
Did I take that too seriously?
What does Corpus Christi mean then?
Body of Christi.
Oh, okay.
No, I don't know. Uh-huh. I don't know.
Just thought of that.
On Monday, May 16th, 1955, was the last time anyone had seen 63-year-old Mrs. Evelyn Scott. According to her husband of almost 6 years, 58-year-old L. Ewing Scott, they had returned to their home at 217 North Bentley Avenue in the western area of Bel Air, California, from a test drive of a brand new cream-colored four-door Mercedes-Benz sedan around 4:30 p.m.
Wow. Bel Air in the mid-50s.
Yeah.
Nice.
That's pretty nice. The car was priced at $2,975.
That was expensive.
That was really expensive back then.
I guess. Well, I don't know.
Okay, so.
Probably.
I did a generalized number because I am going to be talking about money and stuff. $25,000 in the 1950s, 1950 to 1955, was about $330,000 now.
Oh, goodness. Okay, so it's there's been inflation is what you're trying to say.
Just a little bit.
Or I should say the dollar is not worth what it used to be.
No.
Gotcha. Okay.
The couple were planning to visit Europe and needed a solid car to drive, since they were considering living in Spain for an extended period of time. After arriving back home, Evelyn had sent Ewing to the Westwood Village to buy her a can of her favorite tooth powder. When he returned home 35 to 45 minutes later, Evelyn was gone. And so was her car, which was a little red coupe, which was ultimately found by Ewing the next morning, parked on Kelton Avenue, 3/4 of a mile from the house the couple shared. He called a cab to take him to the vehicle and then drove it home, parking it in the garage after first cleaning the vehicle from top to bottom because birds had pooped all over it.
You're not supposed to park the convertible under the tree.
To Ewing, Evelyn's disappearance was a normal occurrence and thought nothing of it, so he didn't worry. He didn't panic. Ewing knew that after a couple days, she would be back, never reporting Evelyn missing. But after 3 months had passed, it was Evelyn's worried and distraught friends that finally contacted the Los Angeles District Attorney S. Ernest Roll with their concerns and suspicions. To them, it was strange that they had all received different answers as to where Evelyn was from her husband Ewing. When they would phone, he told some of them that Evelyn had taken ill and gone for treatment in the East, possibly Baltimore or New York. Some were told that Evelyn was mentally unstable and he was going to put her in a sanitarium, even telling a few of her friends at a dinner party around the end of July that Evelyn had left him, possibly for another woman. Roll, the district attorney, began outlining what Evelyn's friends knew about their close friend and her abrupt disappearance, with the most disturbing information coming from her husband, whose strange and evasive behavior was most troubling. He spoke of institutionalizing Evelyn, who they believed was of sound mind and very healthy for her age. Ewing avoided specific questions about where Evelyn could be found. So what exactly had happened to Evelyn? This was the district attorney's question.
It's a good question. And he was evasive and kept coming up with weird reasons why she wasn't around.
Right. Never really thinking that her friends were actually going to talk to one another and discuss Evelyn's disappearance of 3 months.
She probably ran off with the Fresh Prince of Bel Air.
I know I would. To Evelyn's friends and family, she would never have just left on her own and not contacted them and told them where she was and how she was doing. So something was terribly wrong. Roll agreed to a quiet investigation into Evelyn Scott's disappearance. As far as the DA knew, Evelyn could just show back up into town tomorrow, perfectly healthy with a perfectly sensible reason as to why she had been gone. Because Bel Air in the Los Angeles area does not like scandals, so why create one if not needed, right?
Yeah, it's not illegal to not be there.
It's not illegal to just leave your life.
There's no proof that a crime has been committed.
None whatsoever. All right, so I'm going to read a quote.
You have a lot of sticky notes.
Coming out of my book.
Yes.
I know. First of all, Roll went on, Evelyn Scott is either alive or she is dead. If she's alive, I want to know about it before we stick our necks out too far on this one. If she's dead, we want to know how she died. If it was an accidental death or death by some natural cause, we want to know where her body is. No one in their right mind hides a body unless there's a pretty damn good reason. If we aren't satisfied that Evelyn Scott died naturally or accidentally, men, we've got a homicide investigation.
Seems reasonable.
Absolutely. So one of the things they needed to figure out during this quiet investigation was, what's the motive? If Evelyn was dead and Ewing did have something to do with her murder, why? What did he have to gain? You don't have a body, you don't have a crime scene. So what's the motive?
And they were just, what were they considered? Were they considered married? No.
They were married for six years.
Okay.
But they were older. She was in her 60s and he was in his 50s.
Okay.
Or had she left him for someone else? And was he embarrassed? So he's not telling everybody that she left him. He's telling them that she's crazy and went into a sanitarium, or she's sick and he had to go put her in a hospital.
And because it's Bel Air, it's somewhat probable, plausible, that they wanted to keep things quiet. So if there was something like she was admitted into some sort of facility, he would be evasive as to the details of that.
Right, because you did not air your dirty laundry at that time. We did not have Instagram.
Right. So it's all kind of hearsay and, you know, how do you force the issue if there's no reason to be suspicious?
Especially because according to Ewing, she had left like that before.
Right.
But her friends are saying, uh-uh-uh, no, she hasn't. So it's her friend's word against her husband's word. And then there's the DA and his quiet investigation.
He has to know at some point he's got to come up with something to give them, because him just coming up with different conflicting stories is only going to hold him off for a little while.
Yes.
One would think.
So he needed to come up with some evidence as to where his wife actually was. Yeah, when the DA gets involved.
Yeah, that would be helpful.
Now, Roll and his investigators began interviewing Evelyn's friends again. So they had all come initially and contacted him and said, this is really weird. Our friend is gone. But now it was time to really get into the meat of what had actually happened. So they're going to interview the friends. This time, asking more specific questions, especially about her and Ewing's marriage and relationship. Looking into Ewing's background, the investigators could not find any friends, family, or associates to contact for any information about where this man had actually come from. Now, that was strange. He had no history.
So he just kind of popped up and then they got married?
He kind of showed up.
Huh.
Ewing was Evelyn's fifth husband.
Oh, goodness.
Her first two marriages had ended in divorce, where her next two marriages ended in the deaths of her husbands, leaving Evelyn a wealthy widow times two. So she was married very young initially, and then her husband ended up being an alcoholic, so they divorced.
Okay.
She married again. That husband was also an alcoholic, and they eventually got divorced. Then she met a man who she fully fell in love with. He was a great guy, had some money, and because of his illness, they actually moved from New York to Los Angeles into Pasadena.
Gotcha.
Because Pasadena's where all the money was at that time.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Pasadena was really nice.
It was hopping, huh?
Yeah.
All right.
And then he died, leaving Evelyn just heartbroken. Her fourth husband, she fell in love again, married him, and then her status rose a little bit more because he had some money.
Plus the money from before, plus, from husband number three.
Right. And then he died of a heart attack.
Oh, goodness. She does not have good luck with marriage.
No, and she was devastated. After the unexpected death of her fourth husband, it left 57-year-old Evelyn financially secure, but also a little lonely.
Yeah, she's still young and spry.
Yeah, she's still ready 50s. To, you know, go for it, bust a move, travel. Evelyn's group of close friends and family members filled up some of those hours of her day, but she still longed for someone to share the quiet hours with. In the early summer of 1949, Evelyn was invited to a lovely dinner party. The only other single guest was 53-year-old L. Ewing Scott. So they were kind of set up, I think.
So it's almost by default
that she met him.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Because they were the only ones that were available, so to speak.
The only ones single.
Right.
And Ewing had been waiting patiently for an opportunity like Evelyn, a wealthy widow looking for a companion. She immediately liked Ewing. He asked her about herself and seemed genuinely interested, complimenting Evelyn on her perfume. He lit her cigarettes all night long and charmed her with his old world manners. From that evening on, Ewing was her gentleman caller. And by September, the two had been married. It was only a few months. Once in northern Mexico and once in Carson City, Nevada. Because the one in Mexico wasn't legally recognized in the United States. So they went to Carson City.
All right. So she's a heavy smoker.
They all were.
And she's 57. He's 53. And this is in the 50s.
Yes.
All right.
Can you imagine this? Can you picture this?
Yep.
After only a few weeks of marriage, close friends began to notice a change in Evelyn. She had become more isolated. Ewing had moved Evelyn from her home and all her friends in Pasadena to Bel Air. So it was a little bit of a drive in between.
I wonder if Bel Air was kind of up and coming at that point, or if it was already more prestigious.
I think it was because they had to build their house.
Okay, so that was probably the beginning of
the whole
what is now known as Bel Air.
Yeah, the whole Bel Air scene.
So now those would be the old homes of that area.
Yes.
Because we're talking
about
the
established 50s. Homes.
Yeah.
But Evelyn's entire life was in Pasadena. So she moved her entire life to Bel Air.
Gotcha.
And soon Evelyn realized that she knew very little about her new husband. Ewing was the proprietor of many failed businesses. Mm. But in 1937, he had married the daughter of a very wealthy Canadian publisher and heiress to a family mining fortune. But after 5 years of marriage, Ewing was persuaded to leave his wife after being offered a substantial financial settlement by her family. Now, according to people who knew them, the marriage had been toxic and abusive. Her family was like, get this guy out of here.
The family pitched in and made him an offer he couldn't refuse to leave their mother.
No, to leave the daughter.
Or leave, I'm sorry, to leave the yeah, her.
Yeah, the daughter.
The I don't know who
it's
she,
okay.
Well, I mean, I guess you'd have, depending on who they are, they could be the mother.
No, it was the daughter.
Okay. All
right. And they didn't have any kids.
Because they didn't have any kids. Mm-hmm. All right. Gotcha.
So he was, make him an offer he can't refuse,
okay,
kind of thing.
Perfect. Here's some cash. Just leave.
And he did.
All right.
But Ewing was able to keep his social standing within the Los Angeles area because of his original marriage.
Okay.
He invested in a housing tract near where Knott's Berry Farm is today. Ewing then developed a hair-growing tonic and a pesticide spray. Neither were ever commercially developed because they didn't work.
All it did is cause the bugs to grow hair. Yes. So that's fine.
Yes. It was like the snake oil treatments. That's what he kind of reminded me of. Then Ewing became a house paint salesman. Until one day, he abruptly quit and told a coworker that he was marrying a rich old woman and would be managing her money from now on.
Oh.
That rich old woman was Evelyn.
It's kind of my retirement plan.
Mine too. According to Evelyn's longtime maid, Ewing was verbally, emotionally, and physically abusive to Evelyn and had admitted to not marrying Evelyn for love, but for her money.
Sounds about right.
Yeah, the maid also told a story that she had seen Evelyn and she had a big black eye and like her cheek was all swollen. And Evelyn said, oh, I fell. And then Ewing basically said, no, you didn't. I slapped you in the face.
Oh, wow.
It was awful.
So it's like that.
Yes. Okay. It was like that very quickly.
Goodness.
Eventually, Ewing made Evelyn fire her maid within the first month of their marriage.
Yeah, because he can't have witnesses.
No, and she was crying. Like, Evelyn was so upset that she was firing her maid that she had had for a really long time. I know. I know.
That's not fun.
Also, Ewing dismissed Evelyn's secretary, and within the first year, he took over control of Evelyn's stock portfolio and became her money manager.
That's a mistake.
With barely any experience.
Sure.
On Sunday, May 15th, Evelyn and Ewing were invited over to Evelyn's longtime friend's home, the Bombs, in celebration of Evelyn's birthday, which had just been a couple days before. Evelyn brought up the European trip that she and Ewing were planning, and she was extremely excited. Her friends all said that. She was really excited to be going to Europe.
I bet.
And that was the last time that any of her friends ever saw Evelyn.
Wow.
By the 17th, she was gone. Now, the 16th is the last time that anybody ever saw Evelyn besides Ewing. And it was the car salesman who had brought the car for the couple to kind of drive around to see if they wanted to send it to Europe.
Okay.
So that was the last time anybody had ever seen her.
That's interesting. So they would buy a car and then say, we want to drive this car in Europe, so we're going to buy a car and then have it shipped to Europe, so we'll have it there to drive around.
Yes.
And then ship it back?
Yes.
Couldn't you just rent cars in the 50s in Europe?
I'm sure you could, or you could just buy a car over in Europe.
Yeah. But, I mean, well, then you'd be kind of stuck with it, but, or you could buy it. Yeah, I don't know. That's an odd thing to me.
Yeah, it was very normal.
To purchase
normal
a car and then
during that time.
Ship it there and then drive it and then ship it back.
And they were planning on staying about 3 months.
Well, I mean, if you got the money, I mean, do whatever the hell you want, right? That's the name of the game.
It costs $200 to ship your car to Europe.
Ooh, that's pricey. For the 50s.
For the 50s.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, but I got a coworker friend that shipped a car to Hawaii. And I think it's gone up since the COVIDs, but there's a lot of factors involved. But we'll just say it's around $1,500.
Oh, I thought it would be more.
Yeah, it's not, especially if you're putting stuff in a container. Hmm. So it doesn't really matter. It gets there when it gets there. A big container ship, and then they unload it, and you go pick it up from the port. Anyway.
Good idea.
What I'm saying is, I mean, it's not unusual. It's just, I didn't think back then, you know.
So by the 17th, Evelyn was gone, never to be seen again. 2 weeks after the soft investigation began, Rolls and his investigators sat down to compile the information that each had received from their various interviews with friends and things like that. On August 2nd, Ewing was interviewed for 2 hours. He told an investigator that Evelyn was a cancer-ridden alcoholic and that Evelyn must have left with the $18,000 in cash separated into two envelopes that were in the house that just seemed to disappear when Evelyn did. So if we're saying $25,000 is $330,000, then $18,000.
That's you could do a lot with it.
That's almost $300,000.
Yeah. High twos. Call it 275-ish.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
3 days after Evelyn's date of disappearance, Ewing had signed a co-renter's agreement to gain access to her safety deposit box. And on May 23rd, Ewing opened a Bank of America account using traveler's checks signed by Evelyn and continued to deposit checks and traveler's checks in his accounts throughout the summer months. So these traveler's checks were purchased for their trip to Europe. So she had already signed them.
Gotcha.
But that's what he was using to deposit money into his various accounts.
Okay. Because he managed to get access to their or her safe deposit box.
Yes. Which he shouldn't have. But he bullied his way into
it. That's interesting that they gave him access.
Like I said, he bullied his way into it. When asked where Evelyn was, Ewing said that he did not know and that he never thought to look for her, that she had done this type of thing before. Ewing said that he was going to wait a year before starting to look for her. So is what he's telling the investigators, which is completely different from what he told her friends. Isn't that wild?
It's a little fishy.
Ewing also said that he had never told anyone that he was taking Evelyn to a hospital or sanitarium. But he did feel like Evelyn had been drinking more, and he was hoping that she had left to get medical attention on her own. But what would her friends have to gain from lying to the investigators during the soft investigation?
Yeah.
There was nothing that they were going to gain. They were just worried about their friend. He also said that Evelyn had cancerous tumors removed from different areas of her face. She was showing signs of mental aberrations, and that Evelyn was an alcoholic. Again, that's what he kept saying. She's an alcoholic. She's an alcoholic.
She's a cancer-ridden alcoholic that smokes.
Right. And that could be a lesbian. That was his big thing, too.
Wow.
That she had a girlfriend.
So he's really trying to break her down.
He is.
To anyone and everyone.
He was.
What a swell fella.
After Evelyn had left Ewing, he discovered that she had withdrawn $15,000 from a joint bank account. This is what he's saying.
Oh, okay, right. So he's just making stuff up.
He's just throwing things at the wall, seeing if it's going to stick. For the next 7 months, Ewing was interviewed multiple times. Finances were scrutinized. The home in Bel Air was searched, but nothing was really found to prove that Evelyn was dead. This was all circumstantial evidence. There was nothing. There was barely even any circumstantial evidence. But on March 10th, 1956, searchers were finally given the go-ahead to search the property at 217 North Bentley Avenue.
Uh-oh.
One of the police sergeants named Art Hurdle was watching the search from the home's wooden deck overlooking the Scott's backyard. So what they had was officers with big, long metal sticks probing the ground.
Oh, wow.
Just walking around probing the ground. With 15 years on the force, he tended to go more on instinct and intuition and not necessarily logic, feeling that something was off. He just kept saying, something's off. This isn't making sense. They were searching in the wrong place, is what he kept thinking.
Yeah, or they would have found something.
He walked down to the property's northern rim, and there was a small incinerator built into a low retaining wall. He squatted down and looked inside. All Hurdle saw was the scratch marks from the crime lab technician who had already collected its contents for analysis. So somebody else had the same idea. Okay. Like, there's an incinerator on this property.
That's kind of weird.
Then it hit him. A year earlier, he had been working on a case where a man had killed his wife and buried her body in his next door neighbor's yard.
Ooh.
Positive that police would never look for his wife's body on his neighbor's property.
That was smart.
I thought so, too. I was trying to look up what case this was, and I couldn't figure it out. But I don't know. Someday I'll probably find it. Hurdle then climbed over the retaining wall and dropped down into an empty lot next door to the Scotts. He landed on a thick cushion of leaves. Hurdle began rummaging around, and soon his hand brushed against something hard about 4 to 5 inches under a pile of leaves. He brushed away some dirt and mud, and lo and behold, what did he see?
A hand.
A tooth.
Oh.
He dug around the tooth, and it moved. He lifted it up, and it was attached to a partial dental plate. There were 5 teeth attached to this plate. Guess who wore dentures?
Oh, wow.
Evelyn wore dentures.
Yeah.
Hurdle gently wrapped the dentures in his handkerchief and continued searching. 12 inches away, he saw 2 dozen white tablets. Some were already disintegrated into powder. Amongst the chalky pills was a gooey gelatin substance that looked like medicinal capsules that had melted. Nearby was an empty tooth powder can, a hairbrush, some jewelry, a black cigarette case, multiple cigarette filters, and a tube of Ultrasol, which is a hair product.
Okay.
About 10 feet down the hill, just west of the incinerator, but still on the neighbor's property, Hurdle noticed 2 pairs of eyeglasses under wet and dry leaves. Now, the leaves play an important part because the eyeglasses were underneath wet leaves, but then there were dry leaves on top of that. So they had been down there for a while.
Gotcha. So kind of insulated it.
Yes, yeah. Along with the other things that he had found. Okay. Two. These glasses were partially fixed in a heap of ashes. One pair of glasses was dark rimmed, and the other was a lighter color that had appeared to have faded to a yellow, with a thin dark stripe through the plastic. He gathered up as much of the tablets and white powder that he could, and with a stick scooped up the golden gooey substance. Now it was time to figure out if any of these items belonged to Evelyn. Later that evening, Hurdle drove the denture out to the residence of Evelyn's dentist in Pasadena. The dentist said that he did believe it belonged to Evelyn, but needed to check on the dental plate in his records just to be sure. On Monday, March 12th, the dentist's appliance technician examined the denture against Evelyn's patient records. She had an upper removable. The 5 synthetic teeth fit precisely into the gaps between Evelyn's teeth.
Oh, wow.
The last time Evelyn had been seen by the dentist was on May 13th, 1955, which was 3 days before she vanished. The appliance technician told Hurdle that he was certain that this was his work. He had handcrafted the denture. He knew by the clasps and the way the gold design was made. He was certain that this belonged to Evelyn Scott because everything was made by hand.
Yeah.
So these technicians knew what their work looked like.
Oh, yeah.
Later that week, Hurdle went by the eyeglass store where Evelyn had purchased 2 pairs of eyeglasses. Evelyn's prescription matched with the lenses found in those glasses. She picked up the new glasses on April 29th, 1955. The glasses found in the debris were the same style and colors that Evelyn had ordered only weeks before her disappearance. Even though Evelyn's dentures and eyeglasses were positively identified as hers, these items would not count in a court of law as proof of a dead body or that her husband had killed her. This was still circumstantial.
Because these are just items that belong to her, but they aren't her.
Exactly.
Even the teeth, the partial dentures. Denture is an item. It's not actually her tooth or any part of her.
Right. So if she still was alive, she was walking around without her glasses that she had just ordered and without her teeth in.
It's interesting, but it's not, it still isn't proof.
Nope. Still circumstantial. Hmm. The tube of Ultrasol was traced to a beauty salon in Bullock's at a Westwood department store. Do you remember Bullock's?
Bullock's?
Bullock's.
Oh.
You don't remember that store?
Is it two
It was
words?
Like the fancy store.
Bull and Licks?
No, B-U-L-L-O-C-K-S. Bullock's.
Okay. Nope.
You don't remember that? At the mall?
Negative.
Okay. Well, the manager said that Evelyn bought the product regularly to use at home. Evelyn had been a steady client for the past 3 years at the salon in the department store, and she had not made an appointment in months. Her last scheduled appointment was for May 17th, 1955, the day after she disappeared. So Evelyn went into the beauty salon every week. She had her hair styled.
Yeah.
And that's what you did back then.
Sure.
Is you had a set. So you went in and got your hair washed once a week and they set your hair.
That's what my grandma would do.
I used to do that in beauty school. Yeah. That's a majority of what your clients were.
Your regulars.
Your regulars. According to the salon's records, a man had called the morning of her appointment and abruptly canceled, never rescheduling her.
Oh.
Yeah. Now, found within the ashes gathered from the incinerator were 20 hosiery fasteners for girdles, the metal remnants of a female belt buckle, thin pieces of a lightweight black fabric, and several minute bone fragments.
Uh-oh. There it is.
While interviewing Ewing again, the investigators asked if Evelyn wore dentures. He said he didn't know for sure. He never looked.
How would he not know?
Exactly. When asked if Evelyn wore glasses, he said, yes, she did. He was then asked where her glasses were, and he said that he assumed she had taken them with her because he didn't know what they had found next door. He had no idea.
Gotcha.
They had kept him in the dark. When asked about the remnants of clothing found in the incinerator, Ewing told them that after Evelyn had left, he had found 2 to 3 dresses and some of her undergarments that were soiled, so he burned them. Ewing did not believe that the incinerator had been cleaned out since he had done that.
Okay.
He just kept throwing this poor woman under the bus.
Yeah.
Now she urinated all over her clothes.
Great. Well, I mean, she's, you know,
bastard.
Plus, it was in the 50s. So being in your late 50s in the 50s is like being in your late 80s now.
But her doctor said that she had the mental capacity and the physical capacity of someone who was 15 years younger than her age.
So even though she was a heavy smoker and possibly drinker and all the rest of it.
Not any more than anyone else.
Oh, okay.
But She was fit. She was of sound mind.
All right.
Everything he was saying, he was the only one that thought that.
Okay. So he's just making stuff up to try and bring her down.
Absolutely. The investigators working on Evelyn's missing persons case were convinced that Ewing was responsible for her disappearance. After interviewing the closest people to Evelyn, the investigators believed that she was a mentally stable woman, not the type to vanish on a whim. Evelyn's absence was not her doing. But without a body, how could they get Ewing for murder? Well, they decided that they were not going to go after him for her murder, but prosecuting him for Evelyn because they believed that she was also a victim of fraud.
Okay.
Did that make sense?
Yeah.
That only her murder was preventing Evelyn from testifying against her husband on forgery and grand theft.
So they know he's done something or lots of somethings.
Yes.
They just haven't been able to put it together completely for a trial.
It's just like going after Al Capone for tax evasion.
Right, right.
And getting him on tax evasion, not all these other murders that he had committed or had people commit.
Yeah, that they couldn't prove.
Right. So they had to go around the actual thing that they wanted to get them for.
Smart.
Turned out they had proof that Ewing had been withdrawing money from accounts that were only in Evelyn's name. He had been forging her signature after she disappeared. Crazy, huh? They believe that there was over $50,000 missing. Once again, $50,000 in 1955.
So that means there was more, like she had a lot more.
What I read, she was worth $2.5 million.
Then. Oh, that's lucrative. Goodness.
So she was very comfortable.
Wow. So her first couple of husbands had significant money. If that's how much she inherited or
her
got.
Last two husbands had
right.
decent money. And she had also bought into a piece of property in Milwaukee that was very lucrative and she was making money off of that every single month.
Okay.
So she had made some really smart decisions.
Good.
He had also opened accounts in her name, which was really shady. Soon after, Ewing was given a grand jury summons for April 24th. But the day before the start of the grand jury hearing, Ewing purchased a 1953 four-door green sedan at a used car lot in West Los Angeles under the name R.E. Scott for $900, telling the salesman that he needed a fast car that would go over 80 miles an hour. Was in top mechanical form since he needed the vehicle for an emergency trip and expected to be away for 5 to 6 weeks. When the salesman got home that night, he saw a photo in the newspaper. The man he had met that day as R.E. Scott was actually L. Ewing Scott.
Oh boy.
The man at the center of his wife's disappearance. The salesman called a good friend of his who just happened to work as a detective for the Los Angeles Police Department. So they were watching Ewing very closely after that.
I bet. I'm surprised he didn't split.
He was trying to,
oh, okay.
I think. Yeah. I think he was trying to.
Should have sold everything and beat
dipped.
It. Dipped. Yeah.
For the next 4 days, 22 witnesses were called to testify in the closed-door grand jury proceedings. The last witness called was the car salesman who had sold Ewing the used vehicle. And he told them his story, which made everyone believe that he was going to run, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, I would.
On Friday, April 27th, 1956, the grand jury indicted Ewing on 13 charges of fraud and 4 counts of grand theft and 9 counts of forgery. Ewing's bond was set at $25,000, and within 2 hours, he was free because he was able to pay it.
Oh, my gosh.
Or at least pay the 10%. During this time, Ewing had a girlfriend, and she was also wealthy. She was younger, but she was wealthy. And she believed...
None of this seemed odd to her.
No, she believed everything that he was telling her.
Ugh.
That his wife was gone. She had just left. So on May 5th, Ewing's girlfriend, Marianne, received a phone call from local detectives. Evelyn's red coupe that Ewing had been driving was found parked on a street in Santa Monica, and it had been there for 4 days. Not far from the girlfriend's apartment and the restaurant Ewing and Marianne had eaten at 4 nights earlier, with a bullet hole in the windshield of the driver's side.
Oh.
There was no blood, zero signs of a struggle, and a gun was not found in the car. After no word or sighting from him, 12 days after the last time he was seen, Ewing became a fugitive and a manhunt was launched immediately. Police were flooded with potential sightings of Ewing, but he had a 12-day start. But on the morning of May 21st, there was a real sighting in Bishop, no less.
Oh.
Bishop, California.
That's lovely.
A small mountain town on the eastern rim of California's Sierra Nevada range. The owner of a local motel called Valley Motel had seen a photo of a wanted man named L. Ewing Scott, who looked a lot like a man who had stayed at their hotel 2 weeks earlier, a man named Robert Scott of San Diego. She checked the license plate number given in the paper with the one that she had written down in her records for a green Ford that was parked in front of the hotel for 4 days, and it was a match. So this was the green Ford that he had bought.
Right.
The used one.
Yeah.
So the story goes that on May 2nd, the day after he was last seen by his girlfriend after they had had dinner, Ewing left. He left the LA area and just started driving.
So he just...
He was driving north.
Up and left.
He up and left. Ewing then rolled the car off a road 16 miles south of Bishop. A tow truck pulled his car out of the ditch into a local garage. Ewing said that he must have fallen asleep at the wheel. This is what he's telling the mechanic.
Right.
He needed repairs to the steering column and damage to the body. The repairs were done on Saturday the 5th. He paid $273 for his car, checked out of the hotel, and left Bishop. So he was gone because he'd had a really big head start.
Yeah. He had like almost 2 weeks.
But they knew he was heading north.
Okay.
Obviously, you're going north, right?
Yeah.
By May 29th, Ewing was considered the most wanted man in America. So his picture was everywhere. Almost a year later, on April 16th, 1957, Ewing was detained trying to cross the border into Canada through the Detroit-Windsor Tunnel. He had actually been hiding out in Canada for the last 11 months, but had purchased a new car in Detroit and was stopped at the routine checkpoint. Ewing was now going by Lewis Stewart.
Perfect. I'm trying to keep all these names straight.
I know. The immigration officer recognized Lewis Stewart as L. Ewing Scott. His wanted poster was hanging in a back room in the permit office.
Oh, nice.
The officer had Ewing come inside with him to fill out some paperwork that was needed on every new car that was crossing the border. While Ewing was filling out the paperwork, the officer called the Windsor Police Department. Once Ewing was done, the officer studied the paperwork for a couple minutes. Once he saw the patrol car pull in, he said, "I'm sorry, I can't seem to make out your writing. Is your name Stewart or Scott?"
Nice.
"Why, my name is Stewart. Isn't that what I have written there?" "Yes, sir," said the immigration officer. "That's what you wrote. But the name is Scott, isn't it? Leonard Ewing Scott?" Boom.
Then his heart rate goes through the roof.
Then he pooped his pants.
Yeah, then he just shat himself.
18 hours later, Ewing finally admitted his true identity and agreed to be returned to California.
Oh, boy.
2 years and 2 days after Evelyn's disappearance, Ewing was charged with the murder of his wife and was returned to Los Angeles to face prosecution. On Monday, October 7th, 1957, L. Ewing Scott's trial began for the murder of his wife, without a body. He pled not guilty. The state focused on the finding of Evelyn's eyeglasses and dentures, plus showing a pattern of Evelyn's relationships and behavior that abruptly stopped after she disappeared, proving that Evelyn was not alive. she was dead because she never would have just left.
No.
She loved her friends and family way too much. And that she was murdered by her husband, Ewing, is what the state was trying to prove. Because he never filed a missing persons report with the police and gave friends and family contradicting statements about Evelyn's whereabouts. Now, the defense produced witnesses who testified on the stand that they had seen Evelyn Scott after her disappearance, or someone who looked like Evelyn Scott. After 11 weeks of trial testimony, the case was turned over to the jury. After deliberating for 29 hours, they found Ewing guilty of first-degree murder.
Good.
2 days later, Ewing was sentenced to life in prison. After 20 years in San Quentin, 81-year-old Ewing was released in 1978 without supervision because he refused to agree to parole, as it would imply that he had killed his wife.
Sure.
The California Department of Corrections had tried to release Ewing in the fall of 1974, but he refused to leave.
What?
He refused to leave San Quentin.
Oh, okay.
Believing that if he signed the parole papers, he was admitting guilt, and continued to say that he was being held in prison illegally and without a valid conviction because there was no body.
Yep.
The state then made a second attempt for parole in early 1978, but once again, Ewing turned it down. On March 17th, 1978, he was basically told to clean out his cell and leave. They kicked him out of prison.
So he'd rather be in there than be out.
Yes, because if he was out, then he said it was like he was admitting guilt.
Okay.
I just think he didn't know how to take care of himself anymore.
Probably.
He walked out with a limp and a cane, wearing his prison denims and with $200 in his pocket. Ewing's first act was to divorce his wife, Evelyn, telling people that she was living a peaceful life in Mexico.
Yeah, but everyone knows better. Someone doesn't just R-U-N-N-O-F-T, you know, for no apparent reason.
Did you just spell runoff?
Runoffed.
Runoffed. Now, Ewing died on August 15th, 1987, at the ripe old age of 91 years old.
Wow.
He died in a old people's home. What's that called?
Convalescent hospital, pooping on himself.
He died in a convalescent home.
That's nice.
His body remained unclaimed at the Los Angeles County morgue for more than a week. No one claimed him.
Well, yeah, no one. Who's going to come get him? He's got
Who does he have? He has no one.
Yeah.
The epilogue in the book Corpus Delicti, or Corpus Delicti, by Deborah Wanger, or by Deborah Wagner, actually interviewed Ewing multiple times for her book. He only ever claimed innocence in the disappearance of Evelyn. Okay?
Okay.
But on Sunday, August 5th, 1984, Ewing called her at home and said that he had a story to tell her. It was something she would want to hear, but this would be his last interview with her. She agreed to visit him the next day at his Efficiency apartment off of Wilshire in a rundown area of Los Angeles. While leaning on his walker, he told her his story. He had killed Evelyn. And I'm going to read you his statement from the book.
Okay.
Diane says, "Okay, what is the story you said you wanted to tell me?" "Well," he says, "I arrived in Las Vegas about dusk. I waited until it was dark to point 6 miles due east of the Sands Hotel, and I drove up to that point. I put 4 sticks in the ground so that I would not overcome anything." "Overcome what?" she asked. "The digging of the grave. I got down about 6 feet, which was not any hard job in sand. And when I got that far, I stopped. I went to the car. I got the remains of Evelyn, and I untied the piece of garment I had her in, and I dumped her in the hole." He had wrapped her in like a garden tarp.
Okay.
"After I dumped her in, I took the shovel and smeared it all over with grease so the sand wouldn't stick to it. And I shoveled it all over her, took up the 4 sticks I had planted. After I covered it up, I put the tools in the car, drove around and covered up my tracks, and went to sleep in the car for a while. Then I drove back to Los Angeles. He doesn't say a date, but I assume it's like May 16th or 17th.
Yeah.
Like right after he had killed her. He's saying that Evelyn wasn't wearing any clothes. And she says, "How did you kill her?" And he says, "I hit her in the head with a mallet, a hard rubber mallet. Just once, on the head, right on top. It was that day, the day we went for the test drive in the Mercedes-Benz. It seemed to me that that was about the best day to do it in, and so I just selected it." And she says, "Did Evelyn struggle? Did she see you coming with it?" And he says, "Oh, she had ideas of struggling, but I cracked her right through her hands."
Oh, wow.
She says, "Where were you?" "In the bedroom." "Were you arguing?" "No, I never opened my mouth. I never said a word. I never opened my mouth. And all she said to me was, 'But I haven't done anything.' She's a liar of the first order, I know." And she asked, "Why did you kill Evelyn?" "Why? Because she tried to poison me. That's why. Isn't that a good enough reason?"
She tried to poison her.
That's what he says. And she says, "Do you ever regret killing her?" "No. Why should I? She sure in hell tried to take my life."
Wow.
So he's saying he killed her because he believed that she was trying to kill him, which is a bunch of bull.
Of course.
And she said, "Why did you marry Evelyn?" "Because she wanted me to. I didn't want to marry her. She wanted me to live with her. I said, 'No, I don't believe in that. I will not live with you.' And then Evelyn said, 'Then you're going to marry me.'" She said, "Don't you think you could have lived comfortably with Evelyn? Like, why did you kill her?" And he says, "I don't think so, because there was nothing between us that was compatible. Absolutely nothing."
So he stayed because of the money.
That's what he married her for, was the money.
Yeah.
I think he planned all along to kill her.
Of course.
He was also very old when he was telling her that he killed her.
Oh, okay.
And he only told Diane that he killed Evelyn. He never admitted it to anybody else. And when they asked him on his deathbed about Evelyn and killing her, he said that he had made it up.
Yeah.
And that it would make a good ending for Diane's book. That's why he admitted it to Diane. Now, this case is considered the first U.S. murder conviction without the body of the victim, which has paved the way for more successful prosecutions of murder cases in which no body has ever been found.
Sure makes it harder, though.
It does. But now we have luminol
cameras
where they can find the minute piece of DNA evidence. So there was evidence, I'm sure, but there weren't the things needed to find it.
Right.
Because people have been convicted for murder without a body, but there's been blood evidence. So Evelyn's body has never been found.
So it's out there somewhere, but no one has any idea where it could be, and he won't say.
So if you look at the Sands Hotel, it used to be just desert around there. You look like you're falling asleep. If you look at old pictures of Sands Motel or the Sands Hotel,
yeah,
it was just desert around it. Now it's hotels. So they think that a hotel was built on top of Evelyn's body.
Well, it was a bit sparse back then.
It was. It's not anymore.
I bet there's so many bodies underneath.
Oh, 100%.
Especially with the mafia mob, all that. They hid people underneath stuff.
Yeah, they knew what they were doing back then.
Being involved in the construction process.
A lot of people in foundations in concrete.
Oh, yeah. Concrete under being poured, poured in the middle of the night.
So what is it? The Tropicana or the Flamingo that was just closed? And they're going to demolish it and then rebuild something.
Yep.
How many bodies do you think are in that foundation of the Flamingo or Tropicana Hotel?
That's a good question. I wonder if they find bodies under the concrete.
Then it's a crime scene. Then you have to stop everything.
But they tear everything up and then all that concrete gets ground up.
Oh, yeah.
So if there's a dried up body in there, I don't even think they notice.
Probably not.
No, especially, I mean, this stuff's been, is torn apart by huge, huge machinery.
Yeah, there's no way.
So unless someone happened to notice something, and even then it's like, do you really want to know?
No.
Do you want to be the one that stops the whole operation?
Oh, gosh. Well, Daniel, what did you think of my case?
That's interesting that that kind of paved the way or was one of the first for the conviction without a body or the Corpus Christi delicti. So that's interesting.
I've been waiting to do this case. I was waiting for this book to come in.
Is that the $45 book you ordered?
That's not $45. Oh. It is considered an antique.
Oh, okay.
No, so I got it on expensive. An antique. Not an antique. I got it like at a vintage bookstore online.
Okay.
So I had to wait for a while for it to come in.
Not from the Amazons.
No.
All right.
It was not on Amazon. It was a great book.
Poor Evelyn.
She really just wanted to grow old with somebody.
Yeah.
Somebody that's like, not going to die.
Yeah, like fifth time's a charm or whatever the phrase is.
I think she married him and immediately knew that she had made a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And he is a bastard. Just a horrible
Sounds like
person.
It.
Just married her for her money and then killed her.
I wonder if there's a way for women to realize that they are a target once they've reached a certain level of, I don't know, situation in their life.
Well, the problem is that her friends were trying to warn her. And her friends were saying things like, Evelyn, are you sure? And people put on the pair of rose-colored glasses.
Yeah, that's true.
And only want to see the good in somebody. And it's not always about desperation, but a lot of times it's about loneliness.
Yeah.
That you just don't realize that this is not the right person. That this person is more than likely going to take advantage of you.
Yep.
And we've seen it happen.
Mm-hmm.
A lot.
Yep.
So, I don't know. Maybe listen to your friends and family.
Nope. Definitely don't listen to them.
Well, thank you all for listening. And we appreciate every single one of these downloads. And if you are enjoying our show, if you could go rate and review us, that would be amazing.
Yes.
We do have a Patreon. So if you're looking for more of us, maybe go check out our Patreon. That is very helpful as well. And be careful.
For marriage is a life sentence.
And divorce is always a better option.
Even if it's number 5.
Yes. Mm-hmm. All right. Bye, guys.
Bye.